I mean, this is asking the Congress to, in essence, support effectively an embargo on doing business with China. Yes, there is a lot of support for being tough on China, but it's one thing to be tough on China. It's another thing to try to go down this road of saying no one can effectively do business there.
The AIG Global Trade Series 2024 is a series of podcasts brought to you by AIG in partnership with some of the world's leading centers of expertise on global trade. Visit www.aig.com/GTS. The series moderator is Rem Korteweg of the Klingendahl Institute.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the AIG Global Trade Series 2024. This is your host, Rem Korteweg from the Klingendahl Institute in the Netherlands. And today we're going to talk about the impact of the US and UK elections on trade. Now, first of all, I have to say that this is a special episode because we are recording it live at Chatham House in London, because we are recording on the eve of Chatham House's Global Trade Conference, which is going to take place tomorrow. And we want to take this opportunity to look ahead at the British and American elections and what they will mean for trade policy in the UK and in the United States, but also how those trade policies will or would potentially affect global trade dynamics. And we don't yet know, of course, when the UK elections will take place. We do know it will need to take place before the end of next January, in other words, this year. And based on current polling, Labour is widely expected to take over from the Conservatives. Now, on the US side, of course, the elections are going to take place in November. And based on current polling, it's going to be a toss-up between Trump and Biden. So what factors are shaping UK and US trade policy, and how might those factors lead to changes in the way the US and the UK do trade? And to help make sense of this, I'm joined by two fantastic speakers that I'm going to introduce to you now. Firstly, from Chatham House, so we're at his home, Creon Butler. Creon leads the Global Economy and Finance Program at Chatham House here in London. And prior to joining Chatham House, he was the Director for International Economic Affairs in the National Security Secretariat at the UK's Cabinet Office. And he has served in previous positions at the UK Treasury and the Bank of England. Thanks for having us, Creon. And secondly, a well-known figure to most of you, I'm joined by Jennifer Hillman. Jennifer is professor of practice at the Georgetown University Law Center. She is also co-director of the Center for Inclusive Trade and Development. She has had a very distinguished career in public service, including as one of the seven members from around the world serving on the World Trade Organization's appellate body. And she was general counsel in the office of the U.S. Trade Representative. I know no one better positioned than Jennifer to help make sense of U.S. trade policy, and it's great to have you back on the podcast. And it's a fantastic pleasure to have this conversation with both of you today. Now, as I said, we are recording just before the annual Global Trade Conference at Chatham House. We are also recording the day after Super Tuesday. And I think this all makes it very timely to have this conversation about trade and politics. Now, Creon, if I can start with you. On the UK side, given that we don't yet know exactly when the elections are going to take place, there's a good guess it might happen in, say, the second half of the year, potentially October. How would you expect UK trade policy to evolve in the event that Labour does take over from the Conservatives, as the bookies seem to suggest?
Well, thanks, Rem, and thanks very much for bringing your podcast to Chatham House. I think the key difference between Labour and Conservatives is going to be on the way they view the UK's relationship with the EU. Because the Conservatives took the UK out of the EU, in a sense, I mean, they fundamentally believe that the UK's opportunities rest in the wider world, and therefore necessarily they prioritise trade and investment relationships with countries outside the EU. Now, that's changed to some extent a little bit since the start of last year, actually, with the Windsor Agreement, and that's sort of restored the relationship between the UK and the EU to some extent, but there's still an emphasis on prioritising relations with countries outside. For the UK, they can look at it in a much more balanced way. So they can say, well, where, given we've got a certain amount of political capital to devote and, you know, negotiating expertise and so on, where is it going to get, make most difference to our trading relationships and our prosperity? And, you know, that may mean doing more with the EU, but obviously they are limited to some extent by the real constraints that, you know, short of joining the single market and customs union and so on, which is not going to happen, there's only a limited number of areas where they can actually make progress.
And what then will remain of, for lack of a better word, sort of the Tories' current trade policy, which seems to be to engage with the rest of the world aside from trying to rebuild ties with Europe?
So I think a lot, in a sense, as I said, it will be a more balanced approach. And I think, you know, it's not that Labour will kind of go exactly the opposite direction. I think they will look at all the opportunities and where they should devote their effort. Both parties see the multilateral system as crucial to the UK's future prosperity. I mean, it's very hard work, but I think both sides, you know, put as much effort as possible into trying to uphold what exists of it and trying to extend it. But I think, you know, if you're looking at negotiations with India, development of the CPTPP, I mean, if Labour sees in this opportunities, then they will go that way. I think the difference is they won't have a prior to say it's the wider world rather than the EU.
Yeah. Yeah. And where do you think the US features in that wider world?
Well, I mean, you know, it depends a lot on who wins the election.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that in a second.
We'll get to that in a second. I mean, I think, you know, there's the Atlantic Declaration, which, you know, provides a framework for things outside a formal trading arrangement. And there's an awful lot of work going on in that space, in the sort of economic security space and so on. I think there's also, for example, the things that the UK can do at state level vis-a-vis the US. So there are various MOUs which are, you know, they don't require, you know, legal changes, but they do facilitate trading relationships between the UK and particular regions within the US. Mm. So to the extent that it's possible, you know, Labour and Tories will look at both those opportunities. Both of them will look at that. But I think the broader question of, you know, what administration's in place and are they interested in any, you know, further developments of external economic openness is the real question.
Right. Well, let's bring in the view from the U.S. Jennifer, as I said, it's great to have you with us. There's a lot of speculation about what will happen in November. And I think if you look at the polls, it really is sort of 50-50. You can go a level deeper and look at individual U.S. swing states. And then some people tend to say that Trump might have a better chance than Biden for re-election. We're still a number of months out. So I guess it's fair to say that it'll be a toss-up. What would a Trump presidency mean for U.S. trade policy?
Well, first of all, Rem, it's great to see you. And it's always a pleasure to participate in the AIG Global Trade Series. You know, for me, I think it's very clear that it will mean a marked shift in trade policy. You are already seeing Trump say repeatedly on the campaign trail that one of the things that he would like to do is impose a 10% tariff on all goods from everywhere in the world and a 60% tariff on everything from China.
Even from free trade partners?
Again, that's not yet clear. We don't know all of the details. And presumably that would be quite difficult to do in terms of imposing a 10% tariff on everything from Canada or Mexico or any of our other major free trade agreement partners. So presumably it means everyone other than a free trade agreement partner. But again, we don't know that yet. I mean, this would be a very dramatic change. There would obviously be quite early on a lot of pushing and shoving over whether Trump can actually do that. I mean, whether he has the legal authority to do so. In the United States, the authority to raise tariffs rests with the Congress, not with the president. But over the years, the Congress has delegated some of that authority, given it over to the president under certain conditions and if they meet certain criteria. It's unclear whether this idea of a 10% across-the-board tariff fits within any of those boxes where the president could use authority that's already been delegated to him. Sort of similarly with respect to just imposing a 60% tariff on China, which would effectively be an embargo on our trade with China. Not clear where that legal authority could come from, but the previous Trump administration was quite creative. they imposed 10% tariff on aluminum, 25% tariffs on steel, and used an old 1962 statute related to national security. Mm-hmm. So they've been very clever and creative in finding these small pieces of delegated authority as a way to say, yes, I have the power to do this.
If we really go down that route, it seems like a market shift also vis-a-vis Trump's first term in office, in the sense that wasn't it Trump who struck a phase one deal with China rather than going down the route of 60% tariff? So to what extent would we see a continuation of Trump's first years in office, and to what extent would it be a much worse scenario?
I think it's likely to be much worse. Partly it is because when you look at what's happened, I mean, again, a very recent study came out by David Autor and his colleagues that looked at what has been the impact of the Trump tariffs. So again, they looked very expressly at the industries that were supposedly getting this protection from these tariffs, the aluminum industry, the steel industry, and the major industries that were impacted by the China tariffs. And in theory, the goal of those tariffs for the Trump administration was to increase jobs in those sectors and to increase economic output in those sectors. And what they found was that it did neither of those things. No increase in jobs and no increase in economic output. But the tariffs then were retaliated against. I mean, China and others said, well, if you're going to do these tariffs on us, we're going to put tariffs on you. And those retaliatory tariffs, particularly in the agriculture sector, had a really negative effect in the United States. So the study would show, on balance, a fairly negative outcome from those tariffs. But what it also showed is that they were wildly popular. Significantly increased the support for Trump, significantly increased the support for the Republican Party. And Trump knows that. Mm. So those tariffs being so popular, his message is largely going to be, I will do more of the same of what is already very popular.
Regardless of what it means for jobs ultimately down the road.
Correct.
And then Biden's trade agenda, I mean, some people have been pointing out that in some respects, Biden's trade agenda has continued elements of Trump's trade agenda. How would you characterize what a second Biden administration might do on trade?
So I think you're right that the Biden policy has so far left in place all of these tariffs that I just spoke of. But what they have done is to try to say, we may not be going down the road of a formal free trade agreement, since at some level those words free trade have almost become dirty words politically. But what we will do is focus very intently on supply chains and trying to create resilience and build new pathways for supply chains. But we're going to do it through cooperative mechanisms, things like what they refer to as the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, or APEP, which is sort of a similar process in Latin America, where what you're trying to do is create trade facilitation, you're trying to create transparency, you're trying to map out supply chains, create resiliency around all of the choke points in those supply chains, and use cooperation and transparency to further cement trade alliances, but not go down the road of ultimately providing greater access to the U.S. market, cutting any U.S. tariffs, or engaging in any formal binding agreements.
And I guess a feature of both Biden and Trump, but also both U.K. and the U.S., is this reappearance or this emphasis on industrial policy, this use of subsidies, or at least thinking about how to use subsidies to protect certain sectors. What do you think Trump vis-a-vis Biden would do in terms of the Inflation Reduction Act subsidies that we've seen? Would they be continued, or would Trump reduce those?
Well, I will just say, starting out, just to be clear about the Inflation Reduction Act, by and large, that was the single largest investment in the fight against the climate crisis that ever undertaken in the United States or arguably anywhere in the world. And so for those that are on the climate side, they're very pleased that it was done in this way of providing these subsidies, because they are very hard to get rid of. So while Trump is saying right now that if he were elected, he would repeal the Inflation Reduction Act, what he's going to find is that they have already resulted in significant investments throughout the United States in everything from renewable energies to battery production for storage of that renewable power to the creation of electric vehicle facilities to methane capture. On and on. And those that have received those subsidies, that have got shovels in the ground already building projects, will react very negatively if there is this notion of now withdrawing the subsidies. So I think in many ways, for those that wanted a lasting commitment by the United States to the fight against climate change, they are better off with these kind of subsidies and industrial policy programs because at some level, they are here to stay.
Yeah. So that's actually good news for those that are concerned that a Trump presidency would repeal a lot of the climate measures that have been taken.
I think he will find it very hard to do. Yeah. They have become, again, very politically popular in the same way that he says and will say again that he wants to repeal the major health care act referred to as Obamacare. And as soon as you try to go down that road, what you find is, again, it is very popular and therefore not very easy to get rid of.
But industrial strategy in general, and then I'll bring you in, Creon, from the UK
side.
But
I do think this is where there is a big difference between Trump and Biden. Yeah. Biden believes in this industrial policy, that investing in and supporting U.S. companies in order to get us to a more competitive place vis-a-vis China, that the best way to do that is through this industrial policy and subsidies programs. And Trump believes that the best way to get there is more and more tariffs. Isolate the United States, protect all American industry behind a tariff wall. And that really is a fundamental difference. Biden believes in, I think, the future and the competitiveness and the ingenuity and the innovation of American industry. And Trump wants to build that wall to protect American companies from what they view as unfair competition from the rest of the world.
So what you're saying is that Trump would focus on reducing the trade deficit by blocking imports, whereas Biden is more interested in boosting exports.
Correct.
Right.
I don't know how likely it is, but in the event that you have a Trump wins the presidency, but the Democrats have both houses, I mean, is there any way in which, you know, if Trump goes down this route, as you've described on trade policy, that a Democrat Congress would try and sort of roll it back or hold it back? Or in a sense, is it for the reasons you've said, you know, because it's so popular, you know, in a sense, it's on Trump's head if it all goes wrong, that actually they would not?
Well, again, part of it depends on what exactly does Trump do and whether the Congress wants to put its foot down and say, no, you do not have the authority to do that.
I mean, you can't see a Republican Congress doing that, but, you know, could you see a Democrat-controlled Congress doing that?
Again, the answer, I think, is to some degree, yes. Certainly, if, as you will recall, the changes that were made to what was then the North American Free Trade Agreement to let it become the USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canada Agreement, that required an act of Congress. And Trump was able to get a very strong bipartisan vote in favor of that revised USMCA agreement. However, in this instance, I don't think what he is going to be presenting to the Congress is anything like that sort of an agreement that already had a lot of residual popularity because the NAFTA itself was very popular because the U.S., Mexico, and Canadian markets have become very highly integrated with one another. So there was already a strong wellspring of support for keeping, again, free trade-ish, you know, strong relationships between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. This is a very different proposition. I mean, this is asking the Congress to, in essence, support effectively an embargo on doing business with China. And it's not as clear that there would be wholesale support for that. Yes, there is a lot of support for being tough on China, but it's one thing to be tough on China. It's another thing to try to go down this road of saying no one can effectively do business there. Two reasons for that. One is you're increasingly realizing that not everybody went to China for the same reason. I mean, Trump's presumption is that every single investment that American companies made in China was to take advantage of cheap labor that would then produce goods that would come back into the U.S. market and harm U.S. labor. When in fact, A huge portion of the investment went in order to seek access to the Chinese market. This is, you know, Ford and GM producing cars to sell to the Chinese market, not to bring those goods back at a cheaper price to the U.S. And secondly, you're realizing that within Asia, the amount of intra-Asian trade has simply gone up and up and up. So when you are saying to a company you have to decouple from China, you're also effectively saying you have to decouple from Japan and from Australia and from New Zealand and from Korea and from Taiwan. And that is a much harder ask and will have much more damage to our relationships, particularly with those major trading partners, Taiwan, Japan, Korea. So I don't think it's as simple as simply telling everyone you have to entirely pull out of China.
I want to step across the Atlantic again and to focus a little bit on the UK. Because as far as I understand it, Labour has recently developed a new concept regarding its industrial strategy and how it connects with national security, or from a European perspective, I would call it economic security, which is called Securonomics. Creon, what is the thinking in Labour circles around how to use industrial strategy in this broader context?
Well, I think perhaps a starting point is that economic strategies generally in the UK have never been really very popular. So, I mean, this is over many years. There was with Theresa May a sort of change to some extent because she established a department which had a specific, as in its title actually, the word industrial strategy. But when that was sort of developed further, it turned into, rather than, you know, sectoral policies, into a sort of broad brush approach to developing skills, improving the infrastructure, the broad brush things that, in a sense, everyone in the UK has always thought has been necessary to drive prosperity. It didn't turn into, except perhaps in the technology sector to some extent, in energy sector, but not in a great way, into, you know, very detailed sectoral policies. Now, roll forward to the present time. I mean, people in the UK, as in Europe, watch what has happened in the US very closely. I think there is a very clear understanding that we don't have anything like the resources that the US has, particularly the UK is very constrained in a fiscal sense. And Labour understands that as much as Conservatives understand that. But there is a greater interest on the Labour side in the ideas of, through, you know, sectoral approaches, developing strategic advantages. And I think the sort of national security perspective provides a way into this. So among Labour thinkers, they have looked at this and said, well, okay, in our National Securities Investment Act, we've identified, the UK has identified some 17 sectors. 17 sectors, some of them very broad, some quite narrow, where the view is that we want to resist sort of foreign control, particularly foreign control by hostile states. And there is kind of a monitoring system and the powers to do that. I think what Labour is saying, well, actually, is it just enough to resist foreign influence in those sectors? Or do we need some of those sectors to be further strengthened through certain kinds of support, whether it's industrial support, financial support or regulatory support, so that actually these become strengths in the UK economy? And we do that partly for national security reasons, because this builds our national security, but it is also a way into using industrial strategy to strengthen the economy as a whole. And that is, to the extent that they go down that road and they have the resources to go down that road, that would be quite a shift from certainly the sort of both sort of Blair governments and the subsequent Conservative governments, and also even from the sort of Theresa May approach, which had these sort of broad cross-cutting approaches. Now, I'm not sure how settled it is, because there's still, you know, the strong view that the cross-cutting things, the skills, infrastructure, really matter a lot. And there are choices to be made, because you know, if you have a limited amount of financing, you can either go down that cross-cutting approach, or you can go down a more targeted approach.
It does, interesting, and it does seem to hint at a continuation of some of the policy initiatives that are taken in a G7 context to see how we can protect certain supply chains, how there can be international coordination about stockpiling of certain goods, or even to friendshore certain areas of production, as well as the broader conversation about investment screening. I'm curious, Jennifer, when you listen to Creon describe this, do you think there is a opportunity for US-UK or broader transatlantic cooperation on issues related to, for instance, investment screening or protecting certain sectors that are fundamental to national security in either a Biden or a Trump scenario?
So, yes, I think so, more so in a Biden administration. And the two I'll just point out as an example. One I'd start with would be critical minerals. Yeah. These are all of the minerals that are absolutely essential for the production of batteries, electric vehicles, et cetera. You know, at this moment in time, somewhere between 80% and 90% of those critical minerals are processed in China. And I think on both sides of the Atlantic, there's a strong sense that that is not a road that we can stay on, where we are all so highly dependent for these essential materials on China. So I do think there is real room, and I think the Biden administration right now is very much looking to try to figure out how to develop really good supply chains in these areas in which there would be both high labor standards and high environmental standards around the way in which those minerals are mined and processed, and about where that mining and processing occurs, and under agreements that would again favor a stable and secure and again high standards supply chain. So that is one area where I think there's already a lot of work being done. The U.S. entered into a critical minerals agreement with Japan. There was a lot of discussion about doing the same with the European Union. I presume, again, that there is a lot of interest in also including the U.K. within that. So that's clearly one area where I do see, particularly if it's a Biden administration, further work to try to figure out how to do that in a way that brings in trading partners like the European Union and the U.K. The other is in the digital space and in the development of artificial intelligence, where, again, there is a perception in the United States side that this is one of the areas where we, at this point, still have a competitive advantage, and that we need to be very careful in how we structure moving forward both trade in basic digital, I mean, all digital trade, as well as the development of further on operative artificial intelligence, and where we need to be very careful that we don't end up with two systems or three, but definitely not two systems where, you know, China and its allies, if you will, are using a system and the United States and its partners are using a different one that are not interoperable, so that you end up with significant fragmentation in the digital space. I think that is, you know, one of the things that everybody is trying to figure out how to do that. And at the same time, that's really difficult because it's very clear that the Biden administration has drawn some real lines over the kinds of goods that support a digital economy that may not be shipped to China.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a whole series of goods that may not be imported from China for fear of national security concerns.
But this is, this is the question I'm getting to, which is that Biden has continued some elements of Trump's trade policy, but to what extent could Trump also continue some elements that we've seen emerge in the Biden years? For instance, this pretty assertive use of executive orders to restrict exports, also from allies, of high-end semiconductors or high-end semiconductor manufacturing equipment to China. I mean, I would expect Trump to look at that policy and to say, well, that actually gives me a lever also over Europeans or even over the UK to do what I want.
Well, there's no question that the Biden administration has not added to the tariffs. So their approach is not tariffs, which is really where Trump is. It's just more tariffs and just put higher tariffs on anyone, and particularly this idea of 60% tariffs on China. So Trump, I think, is staying in the tariff lane. Biden really has not. And what they've done is this idea of controlling exports. But to me, that is very different in the sense that it is very rifle shot. It is not all technology that is banned from going into China. It is specific lists of specific technologies that go into the production, again, of high-end, very advanced semiconductors and other kinds of chips and those technologies. And yes, they've done it in a very powerful way, in the sense that they have used what is referred to in the United States as the foreign direct product rule, which basically says if you are producing these semiconductors or others of these technologies using U.S. intellectual property, then you may not export it to other countries like Russia or others that are on these restricted lists. Well, if you step back from it, something between 80% and 90% of the IP to produce semiconductors is American IP. So you're effectively saying, even if the semiconductor is 100% produced in Korea or 100% produced in Taiwan, the United States will stretch its long arm out there and say to those Taiwanese and Korean and other semiconductor producers, you may not export to China or Russia or wherever the United States is saying. So in that sense, it has been a very strong and powerful tool that the Biden administration has used. Now, that tool is a long-standing tool. The right to protect high-tech, technologies that could then be used in military applications and come back and pose a national security risk to the United States. The authority to do that has existed for quite a while. It's just that the Biden administration has made more aggressive use of it, particularly this foreign direct product rule aspect.
Perhaps I could just add one, so that on the sort of underlying question of how far President Trump, a future President Trump, would go down the same route. I mean, I think one of the challenges he would face is, you know, to do this in a sort of multilateral close ally sense, you need to use the G7.
Yeah.
Now, he is not a great fan of the G7. I mean, when Canada had the G7 during his presidency, an agreement, a communique was signed, and then, you know, even after it was signed, he actually disowned the communique because he was unhappy about comments that Prime Minister Trudeau had made when the Canadians were doing the presidency. Similarly, the U.S. had the opportunity to host a G7. In the end, they didn't. But then if you look at the Biden administration, they use the G7 very effectively in this kind of space. So if you look at the Hiroshima summit, one of the outcomes of that was the economic coercion instrument, which has actually been quite effective in aligning G7 countries. So in responding to cases of economic coercion and sharing information and so on. So I think a real challenge for President Trump, which sort of run against his natural instincts, is to do these kind of things. You need to do it in that space rather than simply bilaterally, which I think would be his instinct.
And you saw that so clearly after Russia invaded Ukraine, where the Biden administration really, really leaned into the G7 and to coordinate all of the various sanctions against Russia were highly coordinated through the other allies. So clearly Biden's approach, his instincts are going to be to do this with cooperative trading partners. Yeah. And without a doubt, he would see the European Union, the UK, Japan, and others within that family of friends, allies, and both, if you will, the pro-trade and in this area of national security trade where you're trying to make sure you're restricting those goods that could come back and pose a national security risk.
Right. Bringing it back to the UK for a minute, Creon, there's also the possibility that Labour doesn't win. What would you expect from a continuation of conservative rule in trade terms? Would we simply see a continuation of the previous couple of years, or are there particular elements that you would highlight that might emerge?
I mean, I think the broad strategy will be the same. I think, the UK's membership of CPTPP is in the process of being ratified. I think this is a very interesting thing. I mean, it's not interesting in the sense of the immediate impact on UK GDP, which is very, very small, mainly because the UK already had trade agreements with most of the members. But it's seen as having considerable potential going forward as a kind of UK, Japan, a few other countries kind of led framework, which could extend beyond those countries to include other middle-sized economies. It has some very high-quality elements, actually, thanks to the US. It sort of was at the core of its design, particularly in data sector. So I think, you could see big effort in that respect. But I think also on the sort of really big trade deals. I mean, with India would be the example. That's not going to happen soon, as far as I can see, notwithstanding all the effort that's going into it. But, I mean, that will be a priority for a Conservative. And, but again, I'm not sure that that would be much different from Labour in that sense.
Right. I have one more question for both of you, which is, how important do you think trade policy is going to be as a feature in the election campaigns? I mean, will it feature at all? Will we see Keir Starmer make a big speech about trade policy? Will Trump and Biden in their town hall election meetings, will they emphasize trade? Or is this something really for the aficionados like ourselves to watch?
So it's interesting to look at. So the according to the Pew Research Center's very recent polling data that listed out 20 factors and said, okay, what are Americans' top priorities going into the election? Everything from strengthening the economy to concerns over education to protecting the environment, and included on that list of 20 factors was dealing with global trade. And dealing with global trade came in 20th out of 20.
Oh.
So as a general matter, when you just poll for how much do Americans care about trade, the answer is not. They don't care about trade. And yet, as I said at the beginning, the idea of putting on tariffs, of bashing China, of this America first that I'm sticking up for the steel workers and the aluminum workers by taxing China is very politically popular. So I definitely think you will hear it more from Trump than you will from Biden, because Biden's approach to trade is much more nuanced. And I think Biden will instead focus on the factors that are the number one, two, three, or four on this list rather than staying down at what is number 20.
I mean, sadly, I don't have polling data, but so to the extent that trade is linked to industrial policy, I think you will see Labour trying to make more of its greater enthusiasm for industrial policy. So that will be one positive factor. But it's not a wedge issue in the UK more generally, and as we've discussed,
but the EU certainly is.
Except that the, you know, Labour's approach is to change the nature, to change the tone of the relationship. Yeah. But in terms of what they fundamentally would do, I mean, the big things like joining the single market and so on, these are not on the cards, certainly not for a first term.
No.
And it's hard to see how it would make any sense, actually, even in the longer term while the UK remains outside.
Yeah.
So I think it would be the industrial strategy area where trade, if you, to the extent it's linked to that, becomes an issue.
Terrific. Unfortunately, this is all we have time for today. This has been absolutely fantastic. It's getting me all psyched up to watch both election campaigns. I hope that counts for you as well. Thank you very much to Professor Jennifer Hillman and Creon Butler for talking to me today. It's been most fascinating. And thanks again, Creon, for allowing us to make use of Chatham House's facilities for this. Please check out our other conversations for the AIG Global Trade Series at www.aig.com/GTS or get them through your podcast app.
The AIG Global Trade Series 2024 is an international partnership between AIG, the Aspen Institute, Germany, CEPRI, the Brazilian Center for International Relations, Chatham House, the Klingendahl Institute, Elcano Royal Institute, AREA, the Economic Research Institute for ASEAN and East Asia, IIEL, the Institute of International Economic Law at Georgetown University Law Center, ISPI, the Italian Institute for International Political Studies, the Jacques Delors Institute, Rieti, the Research Institute of Economy, Trade and Industry, and the St. Gallen Endowment for Prosperity Through Trade. To access articles and opinion pieces from partners in the Global Trade Series, and to listen to more episodes on global trade, visit www.aig.com/GTS or follow the AIG Global Trade Series wherever you get your podcasts. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by our speakers are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organisation, company, individual, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no representations as to accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and will not be liable for any errors, omissions, or delays in this information, or any losses, injuries, or damages arising from its use.